For Leonard Lopate at Large coming up at 1 p.m., followed by the Tom Hartman program at 2 p.m. This is your listener-sponsored community radio station, WBAI, in New York City, and broadcasting at the 99.5 FM dial, as well as streaming worldwide at WBAI.org. Stay tuned for Leonard Lopate at Large coming up.
Leonard Lopate at Large. I'm Leonard Lopate. Theodore Roosevelt was an inspiration to Americans in many ways. He was a hero of the Spanish-American War, a naturalist and conservationist, a creator of national parks, a proponent of the bully pulpit, and for his corollary to the Monroe Doctrine. According to Ryan Swanson, an associate professor of history at the University of New Mexico's Honors College, Roosevelt also played a major role in developing the American love of sports and physical fitness. During his term as president, there was an unprecedented rise in sports and recreational activities. It was when the first Baseball World Series was played, the NCAA was created, and the U.S. hosted the Olympics for the first time. Professor Swanson's latest book, The Strenuous Life, Theodore Roosevelt and the Making of the American Athlete, tells that story. It's published by Diversion Books and brings Ryan Swanson to our show now. Welcome.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Where does the word strenuous in your title come from?
Well, it comes from a speech that Roosevelt gives in 1899 called The Strenuous Life. And it's a speech, as many people know, perhaps, that is really about diplomacy, or maybe actually conquering our imperialism. He's talking about foreign relations, but it's a speech that really becomes closely connected to living a vigorous, active, athletic life. And so Roosevelt coins this phrase, the strenuous life, and it really comes to be connected to athletics. And so that's where the title comes from.
The word implies arduous and difficult. Was the suggestion that athletics are also a test of character?
Yeah, Roosevelt, along with a lot of people at this time, sees athletics as a path towards kind of testing oneself in a time that they think is really getting too easy. The United States is well into urbanization and industrialization at this point, and so there's a widespread concern that people have it too easy. You know, unlike our grandfather and grandmother who were out working the land, we're just doing these factory work, which might be dangerous and boring, but not particularly taxing. So kind of like some of the concerns we have today, perhaps, about our kids, you know, playing too many video games or something like that.
You can only wonder what he would have thought about television and cell phones and the like. You write that the word strenuous was used in newspapers to describe Roosevelt thousands of times in all kinds of contexts?
Yeah, that's right. It becomes, so I count in some ways. In 1902, the first full year that Roosevelt is in the White House, more than 10,000 times Roosevelt is described using the word strenuous. And like you just said, it's used in all sorts of ways. You know, the press will say he's a strenuous eater or a strenuous vacationer. He raises his kids in a strenuous way. They actually tweak the word, too. You know, they talk about his strenuosity. So this, you know, this becomes the way that the press likes to kind of capture this energy.
He was
different from the way the White House had been before.
He was asthmatic as a child. How common was that ailment then, and how serious was it considered?
I mean, Roosevelt has a terrible case of asthma. It's not, you know, just a little tightness of breath or something like that. Really, from about age 3 until he hits his teen years, incapacitated by asthma. He's got these crises really on a daily basis. So the family can't send him to school. He can't participate in athletics of any sort. And so when we think about Roosevelt's role in athletics, you have to go back to this point because he struggles so much as a child to be active. And this story is well told in many places, but still fascinating, I think. When Roosevelt hits his teen years, his father calls him in for a kind of father-son chat. And to paraphrase, he says to his son, you know, I'm proud of you. You're well-spoken. You're a smart kid. You read a lot. But unless you make your body, he says, you're not going to turn into anything. And so basically the dad challenges the son to cure his own asthma, which, you know, I'm a dad. That doesn't seem real fair to me. But Roosevelt takes the challenge, and from that point forward, he really dedicates himself to physical training and to boxing. And something miraculous happens. He you know, his asthma basically goes away, not completely, but now what we know today is it's very common for teenagers to kind of age out of the worst of asthma. But for Roosevelt, he absolutely connects the two things. You know, I exercise, therefore I got stronger. And he'll remain convinced that that connection should be true for him and for the nation. And so that kind of takes him into the White House.
So there were no medical treatments available for asthma in those days? No inhalers and such?
Yeah.
He was homeschooled, you suggested. That because he couldn't, because that was the only, because he was physically incapable of going to a regular school?
Yeah, well, I mean, the way that asthma was understood in the middle of the 19th century was that it was both physical and emotional. So many children who suffered from asthma were seen as kind of emotionally weak and fragile, too. So sometimes they were basically thought of as fakers.
Shirkers.
And so his, you know, yeah, and shirkers. So his parents tried him at school for a little while, but then kept him at home with a personal tutor. The Roosevelt family has many means, and so they're able to get him a great education at home. Roosevelt really struggles from asthma. And in terms of treatments at the time, no, the albuterol inhaler, which we see today, doesn't come around until the 1950s. And so Roosevelt tries all kinds of terrible things to deal with asthma. His parents have him do shock therapy. They try bloodletting. They have these really terrible massages that will actually cause him to break out. They'll take him out in the cold in the middle of the night. They have him smoke cigars as a kid. All these things trying to calm those airways. Interestingly enough, what Roosevelt settles on, the family thinks coffee is really does as well as anything. So perhaps that's why he's such a prodigious coffee drinker when he's older. I'm not sure.
He also joined Wood's Gymnasium. Where was that institution and who ran it? Were they contributors to Donald Trump's campaign?
No. No, not necessarily. I mean, Roosevelt actually is part of a number of boxing gymnasiums in New York City. I mean, this is a New York City story.
Is it like today's gym membership? Similar?
It's the beginnings of it. You know, the United States today spends billions of dollars a year on memberships, probably many of which don't actually get used. But, this is the beginning of the era where people are living in cities, they're working in jobs that are not necessarily that rigorous, and, you know, they don't have exercise space around them. So this is the beginning of come, pay, and we'll help you work out. But at the time of Roosevelt, it seemed very much as something for the elite, and it's still pretty rare at this point. But this is the beginning of that movement where you go work out somewhere else and pay somebody for it.
Wasn't his father Theodore Roosevelt Sr.? You never hear of Teddy Roosevelt as Theodore Roosevelt Jr.
Yeah, that's right. I'm not sure if it's just because the son eclipses the father in fame. But yeah, Roosevelt's father was very successful as a businessman. Roosevelt's grandfather had, you know, been very successful in Manhattan real estate and in glass production. And so the family is very wealthy, but it's Roosevelt's father who kind of extends the Roosevelt family into philanthropy and charity and good works. The family helps build a YMCA in New York City. So Roosevelt comes from wealthy stock and has a lot of opportunity, even though he, like most politicians, likes to talk about kind of raising himself up by his bootstraps.
What do you mean when you write that Roosevelt approached his athletic development like a natural scientist?
Well, Roosevelt loves data. He loves record keeping. So Roosevelt, as he's kind of, you know, so he has that talk with his father where his dad tells him basically get it together. And so Roosevelt starts training with a variety of trainers and boxers, but he keeps fastidious records of everything that he does. So he'll go out and run a 100-meter dash, and he'll time himself. He competes a lot against his youngest brother, which is really unfair, and he writes down all the records. You know, I jumped 12 feet, and my brother only jumped 10 feet, and we boxed for 3 rounds, and I won all 3. And so he really wants to keep track of measurements and distance and speed. So his scientific kind of mind is at work, I think, with athletics. It's never just get out there and play. It's always with a plan.
So he became healthy enough to be able to go to college, and he went to Harvard. Mm-hmm. How important were college sports when Roosevelt went to Harvard?
Pretty one of the era of intercollegiate athletics. So Harvard, and Harvard is the kind of powerhouse of the time. I mean, it's tough for us to think, but I mean, think of Harvard as some combination of kind of the University of Alabama and Ohio State when you think of sports. So Roosevelt gets to campus in 1876, and the Harvard Crimson are really strong in football and baseball and crew. And so Roosevelt is there, and he's around it. He writes about it for the school newspaper at times, but he himself is not good enough to compete. But he does take boxing lessons and continue to get into the gym individually throughout his time at Harvard and kind of compete intramurally there.
And then his father died suddenly during his sophomore year. How did that affect him, and did that change his relationship to athletics?
Yeah, so Roosevelt's father passes away. Even though the family had some concerns about his health, it really takes Theodore by you know, just shocks him. So he goes into a prolonged period of grief at the end of his sophomore year. And, I thought something interesting happened as he goes through that grief. On the one hand, athletics is always a struggle for him. So initially, after his dad dies, he stays away from the gym. It's not something, perhaps if you're a good basketball player and something goes really badly for you, what do you want to do? You want to get out on the court because you can forget everything else. That wasn't Roosevelt. Athletics wasn't that kind of easy for him. But as the pain subsides and from his father's death, he redoubles his efforts to kind of live up to that challenge he made, or his father gave to him. So, he goes even harder at boxing and training. Right after, kind of maybe 6 months after his father dies, he puts together a running plan where he's going to run a mile at full speed every day because he's going to develop his lungs. So I would say his father's death pushes him to even further develop himself physically.
Who was Dudley Allen Sargent, and how did he shape Roosevelt's ideas about athleticism?
Yeah, so Dudley Sargent is the first director of athletics, basically, at Harvard. And he is right at the dawn of physical education as any sort of academic discipline. And when he gets hired at Harvard, right when Roosevelt gets there, some people think, physical education isn't really a real academic thing at all, so it's kind of just on the cusp. But Sargent comes into Harvard and takes over a gym, which they're in the process of building, and he really sets out what we would think of today as the study of, kinesiology and exercise science. And so Roosevelt graduates in 1880, and by the time he does that, Sargent has convinced the school to let him take measurements of every student before he graduates. And so he, when Roosevelt's getting ready to graduate in 1880, Sargent brings him in and does 60 measurements on him, everything you can think of. And in looking at him and learning about his asthma history, it's Sargent who tells Roosevelt as he leaves Harvard, you should never exercise again. If you do, you will die of a heart attack. So he gives him this ultimatum, which Roosevelt basically shirks off. But Sargent's really important in developing what we know about exercise and the body.
And Roosevelt didn't have a heart attack?
Well, not right away. I mean, Roosevelt passes away at the relatively young age of 60, but no, he lives a vigorous, aggressive life for the next 40 years after that warning from Sargent.
What did he do after he left school? How long before the Spanish-American War broke out?
Yeah, so almost 20 years. I mean, he graduates in 1880 and gets married right away and thinks about going to law school at Columbia, but hates it. And quickly decides to run for office. So he's elected shortly after graduation to the New York Assembly. But then I would say his life goes off the rails a little bit in that his first wife, Alice, dies in childbirth. And so he, for a couple of years in the mid-1880s, heads off to North Dakota to kind of find himself. And he, leaves his new daughter with his sister and spends a couple of years ranching and playing cowboy a little bit. And then he comes back and increasingly takes on roles in New York City and in the federal government, which will lead him to be in a position where he can lead up the Rough Riders in 1898.
He wrote a lot, including some memoirs, and he didn't even mention Alice in his first book. Do we have any idea why?
Right. I think the consensus is, and it would be my argument, that it was just so painful for him that he decided the best way to deal with it was not to talk about it. So he writes a really poignant obituary for her, and that actually is published shortly thereafter. But then he doesn't talk about his first wife really at all, and the daughter from that marriage, Alice, grows up, and she'll talk about how she really feels left out of the family, that he has a second family that comes with Edith. And no, but he doesn't even talk to Alice about her mother, who's passed away. So it seems to be a grieving mechanism that he uses.
I'm speaking with Ryan Swanson, whose latest book is The Strenuous Life, Theodore Roosevelt and the Making of the American Athlete. This is Leonard Lopate at Large on WBAI, New York 99.5 FM. So he got into politics. He first the state legislature, But meanwhile, he's also developing a kind of a cowboy persona with his ranch in North Dakota.
That's right. You know, Roosevelt, I think, is self-conscious of the fact that he is a child of privilege, and he's grown up on the East Coast. So after losing his first wife, and his mother actually dies on the same day, he spends several years in North Dakota. He buys land, and he buys cattle. And so when I say he plays cowboy, that's probably unfair, but he spends years in the West, and he is a cowboy for a time. But also he really loves to later talk about how much of a cowboy he was. So yeah, he's the real deal, but he also knows how to use it politically. And so that becomes really part of his persona. And I think it helps when we think about the strenuous life in athletics, because we kind of associate, or his contemporaries associated his time in the West with this kind of robust man and athletics.
And did that lead to his creating the Rough Riders?
Yeah, so... It, to a certain extent, Roosevelt moves through the ranks. He's commissioner of police in New York City and a couple of other positions, and ends up as assistant secretary of the Navy leading up to the Spanish-American War. And when the war breaks out, Roosevelt's coming up on 40, you know, so I don't know, some sort of midlife point perhaps. And he says, you know, there's no way he wants to help plan this from afar. He wants in on this battle. And so when he gets a chance to help put together a regiment, he wants two things from the Rough Riders, or two characteristics. He's looking either for people from the West, particularly the Southwest, actually. He wants people from the Southwest because he thinks those kind of men are really tough and they'll serve well in combat. And then the second type he's looking for are college athletes, or former athletes. And so, yeah, I think his background in the West and his association with athletics absolutely connects then into the Rough Rider experience, which is a pretty short military experience, but Roosevelt, too, will be really, he'll talk about it for the rest of his life, certainly.
And how important was their role in the war?
I mean, Roosevelt...
More symbolic than actual winning of battles?
I would... are you talking about Roosevelt, yeah. his regiment?
The Rough Riders.
I mean, yeah, the Rough Riders... It certainly garner more than their share of attention, but I would argue that that is because they get so much attention, not because they don't do anything. The Rough Riders show up in a difficult situation, and they help a really deadly assault come to fruition, and they help gain control of the territory. So the Rough Riders, they are by no means a kind of some symbolic or ceremonial unit, but they also really come to kind of capture the public's idea of what the war was. While, of course, they didn't do it all themselves. So it's real service, but it's not perhaps the only thing that happens, as some people remember it.
And you said that when the war broke out, he was McKinley's assistant secretary of the Navy. Was it his goal to run as McKinley's vice president after Vice President Garrett Hobart died?
No. No, Roosevelt. Well,
Roosevelt served as governor of New York State as well, so he was already interested in elected office.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, so Roosevelt comes back from Rough Riding, and, I mean, within 8 months is governor of New York, despite the fact he's living in Washington, D.C., which is a bit of a problem at the time, but he's so popular after the war that he becomes governor. He does not want the vice presidency. Like many politicians, he fears that it's a dead end, and so when things begin swirling about him being added to the ticket, by all accounts he's not feigning when he says no, I don't want it. He really doesn't want it, and he feels there's much more he can do that's important and that'll help him get elected president if he stays as governor of New York. But in the end, the convention really pushes, and he's added to the ticket. And once he's added, like everything Roosevelt does, he goes full bore. He gives 600 speeches leading up to the election, and so he really goes after it once he's on the ticket.
And they won in a landslide based on a platform of peace, prosperity, and conservation. Was he the one who injected conservation into that?
I mean, I think, Roosevelt is, from as he's moving up the ranks politically, conservation is always an issue of importance to him. Now, he'll, later on in his friendship with John Muir, he'll kind of develop it further. But Roosevelt always believes that the natural resources of the United States need to be protected, but not, kind of kept sacrosanct. They need to be usable, but protected. So I think he plays a role in influencing McKinley to continue to embrace the same thing.
Now, you've written other books. In fact, one about baseball, which was not one of TR's favorite sports. But was your original interest in the growth of popularity of American sports or in Teddy Roosevelt when you started working on this book?
Yeah, my interest was in how sports got to where they are today. So when it's kind of interesting to think back after you've been on a project for a long time how it came about. But when I look back, I kind of see two strains that led me to write about Roosevelt and sports. On the one hand, it was very much because I've written about sports before and in the development of college conferences and baseball and these kinds of things, you can't do much in looking back at sports without seeing Roosevelt's name kind of thrown in there. So part of it was just that, all right, Roosevelt seems to be linked with this, but nobody's ever explored it very well. So that was part of what brought me to the question. But I would say equally as important, we all live our own lives as we are scholars or workers. So I have three kids who are in youth sports. And, you know, sitting on the sideline of this game or that game oftentimes leads me to think, you know, why are we doing this? Is this really building character? Is this the best thing for our kids? Why do we have big Super Bowl parties, and why do these things happen? So at the root of this book is just the question of why are we so crazy about sports, and how did we get this way? And Roosevelt is a fun vehicle to help explore that topic.
Photographs of him don't suggest that he was very physically fit. Did he continue to engage in athletic activities, or was he mostly an armchair athlete when he got into politics?
No, so Roosevelt, through his whole life, is engaged in athletics certainly on a weekly basis, but pretty close to a daily basis. He loves to ride horses, he loves to box, he loves to wrestle, he enjoys going for long trail run hikes, and that continues through his 40s, 50s, and 60s.
And then he added a tennis court to the White House after he became president.
That's right. Yeah. Okay. So he adds.
That's before presidents started playing golf.
Yes, Roosevelt will warn Taft, who follows him, to stay away from golf because he sees that as kind of deadly politically. But Roosevelt's never an armchair guy. He's less a fan than he wants to be a participant, even if he's not particularly good at this sport or that. But as you say, the photographs show him as a rather plump individual by the end of his time, too, and that's because, you know, as much as he loves to play sports, the guy can eat. Every meal is kind of a celebration. So like all of us, or at least like I can relate to, you know, it's one thing to continue to exercise as you get older, but you can't keep eating like a teenager. And that's basically what he does for his whole life.
He became president after William McKinley was assassinated. Why did he decide to renovate the White House?
Simply put, he's got a lot of kids. He's got six kids, so I think that's a big part of it. Also the White House is in terrible disrepair by this point. As the duties of the executive office expanded, the building stayed the same. So there's no place for the press. There's no place for the cabinet to work. And on a practical level, too, it's badly out of code. I mean, the place was a fire hazard in terms of open wires and, not a proper sort of sprinkler system as we think of it today. So the place needs an overhaul, and Roosevelt, right at the beginning, goes to Congress and asks for $600,000 to do it, and they give it to him, and he does it. It's a pretty risky move politically. I wouldn't think it would go over very well, but he seems to just head into it and get it done within the first year that he takes over.
Well, he was considered an American hero at this point. He probably God allowed him to do all sorts of things that maybe other politicians couldn't have done.
Yeah, he certainly has some capital to spend, and he uses it. Yeah, and throughout his time, his popularity ebbs and flows a little bit, but he is very popular with the American public, and he knows how to use that. Obviously, the idea of the bully pulpit and those things going forward, he knows how to use it.
Where did he get the nickname Bull Moose?
Well, because he says he's going to come charging in like a bull moose, you know. So and I think it fits his personality too. So the idea that he's not going to stand back and watch as, you know, say the election of 1912 takes place, he comes in as a third party candidate, and so I think it's a pretty apt description of the way that he acts politically.
Was there any controversy about his adding that tennis court?
A little bit. There's a couple of Democrats who argue that it's just improper for this type of spending. So there's actually a couple of speeches on the floor of the House saying that we need a new president in 1904 because we can't afford Roosevelt. Look at him. He's redoing the White House. He's putting in a tennis court. And so there is some of that pushback. And because of that, Roosevelt doesn't invite the press to see him play tennis hardly at all. And so it's kind of kept behind canvas, and he plays. Everybody knows he's playing, but he tries to keep it out of public eye as much as he can.
And do we know whether he was a good tennis player?
We do. He was not a particularly good tennis player. You know, the times when the Washington Post gets in and watches a couple of times, and then his daughter talks about him, from what we can tell, he lacks any sort of, strategy on the court. He kind of is a straightforward player. He bangs the ball as hard as he can. He loves to play up at the net. He loves to play doubles, and basically what happened was oftentimes his partner is left to cover the whole back of the court because Roosevelt's just kind of at the net in no man's land. But his point was always work up a sweat, compete hard, enjoy time with fellow athletes. So while he always played to win, he was not a sore loser when he got bested, which happened fairly often.
You said that he put athletes into the Rough Riders. Did athletics figure into Roosevelt's selection of his cabinet?
It does. More so, he has his official cabinet, of course, which is relatively typical of the time, long-established, older, white men, which is the way it is at the beginning of the 20th century. But Roosevelt has a secondary group, which becomes known as the Tennis Cabinet, which is about 35 much younger men from the civil service and from government positions. And these are guys who can play sports. Many of them are former college athletes. They'll come and play tennis with Roosevelt, or they're hud out on one of these trail hikes he loves to do. And so this group, the Tennis Cabinet, many people would argue, and I would concur, becomes every bit as important as the actual cabinet. And these are athletes, and these are people playing with Roosevelt while he is president. And so they're really important in him making decisions.
How did his daughter Ethel become a role model for girls and women interested in athletics?
Yeah, so as sports are developing here at the beginning of the 20th century, there's no doubt that this is long before any sort of equality in terms of opportunities for boys or girls or men or women. But one of the sports that's somewhat open to girls' participation is tennis. And Ethel takes to it. And so she's known to play on the White House court or when the family gets away to New York in their retreat. And so the press becomes aware of the fact that she is not only playing tennis, but that she seems to be the best tennis player of the whole Roosevelt group. She could take her father. She could beat her brothers. And so this story of her being athletic, and because of the times, they would often say, yes, she's athletic, but she's also very feminine and beautiful. This becomes part of thinking publicly about what sports can be for girls. And so she is a role model in that way, although the time certainly limited what she could do.
And tennis remained one of the chief sports for women all the way through until the point where people started questioning whether women were being excluded from sports.
Yeah, tennis is a really important sport in terms of thinking about gender equality. And I think even carrying forward to today, you can really make the argument that Serena Williams is the greatest athlete of our times. And, it's been tennis that's been, her vehicle to do that. So I think tennis needs to be thought of in that way.
You're listening to Leonard Lopate at Large on WBAI New York 99.5 FM. We're back with Professor Ryan Swanson, who is a professor of history at the University of New Mexico Honors College and the author of a number of books, When Baseball Went White, Reconstruction, Reconciliation, and Dreams of a National Pastime. Also, separate games, African-American sport behind the walls of segregation, and now this strenuous life, Theodore Roosevelt and the making of an American athlete. And we'll get to the race relations in a little bit. But in your introduction, you tell a hilarious story about a relatively low-level member of Teddy's administration being invited to the White House for a game of tennis. Who was Lawrence Murray?
Yeah, Lawrence Murray is just as you described it. He's a low-level member of the civil service who's newly back in town. But Roosevelt hears that he's played some tennis in his day. So the story that I tell, and I won't spoil it all. Hopefully, people will read it in the book. But Roosevelt, and I think his story is indicative of what happens to a number of young men during this era. Basically, the White House reaches out to Murray and says the president would love to invite you to come play tennis at 4 o'clock in one summer afternoon. And you can, you know, what do you say? Of course, you say yes. You know, nobody turns down the president. So Murray goes shopping for a new tennis outfit so he looks good and shows up at the appointed time to play tennis with the president. And it's stressful. Murray writes a really funny kind of memoir of the experience where they're going to play doubles, and all he wants at the beginning is don't let me be on the team with the president. You know, he doesn't want that stress. But they have a tradition of throwing up their rackets and seeing which ones align with each other, and he ends up being Roosevelt's partner. Mm-hmm. So they play, and by all accounts, Murray does fine. He doesn't, you know, he doesn't screw up too badly. He doesn't hit Roosevelt with a tennis ball like a couple of other people did. And I think Murray's relieved when a thunderstorm rolls in and the game has to be called off. And so, you know, the quartet steps off the court and heads right into the office, which is just mere steps from the tennis court into the president's office. And Murray thinks he's done it. You know, all right, I've come, I've socialized, this has been great. He thinks, you know, maybe they're going to break out drinks now and just chat like civilized people. But Roosevelt instead says, "What a perfect day for a romp through the wilderness," basically. And so instead of playing tennis, he tells them to put down their rackets and they head out through Rock Creek Park, which even today is, you know, pretty wild if you walk off the trails in Rock Creek Park in Washington, D.C. But so they head out in Rock Creek Park, and, you know, it doesn't take long before Murray is falling way behind. He loses his shoes in the mud because it gets so muddy. And then kind of when he's at his lowest point, he hears Roosevelt say, "All right, let's jog it the rest of the way back in." And he says, you know, "At this point I realize there's no doubt Roosevelt is crazy." And so Murray is left for dead. They leave him behind, and later a couple of the other guys will come back and get him. But this is his introduction to the strenuous life and a different kind of president. And I think his experience is telling of what it was like to meet Roosevelt in this context.
And I suspect he didn't get asked back.
Well, actually, you know what he does? He goes out and gets a trainer. He starts training so that he can keep up with the president, and he starts getting into shape, and he does keep getting invitations. He does much better in the future, and Roosevelt actually kind of loves him for it. You know, here's a guy who I kind of destroyed on the first try, but he's pulled it together, and he becomes one of Roosevelt's companions in the last part of his time in the White House.
One of Roosevelt's first big public appearances after becoming president was at the Army-Navy football game. Was anyone nervous about him appearing in public in such a big venue following a presidential assassination?
Yeah, absolutely they were. It's 78 days after McKinley's been assassinated, and there are real concerns about whether it's safe at all for a president to go out in a public situation like this. And remember, this is a time when presidential security is very much up in the air. As this is happening, the Congress is debating the idea of the Secret Service, you know, who pays for it and what jurisdiction do they have. And so as Roosevelt decides in November of 1901 to go to this Army-Navy game and basically bring all of important Washington with him, yeah, there's absolute concerns that this could be a recipe for disaster. Because remember, there are people in the United States at this point who can remember the assassination of three presidents. You know, depending how old you were at the time. So there's real concern that this is just inviting someone to do something to the president.
So what kinds of precautions were taken? He wound up running out onto the field.
Yeah, the Philadelphia Police Department does everything it can. It basically closes off every kind of thoroughfare to get to Franklin Field that can possibly be closed off. They get every available police officer and federal officer they can into the area. And then they stop the train short of the station and close things down there. So Roosevelt, they do everything they can. But you're right, once Roosevelt gets into the stadium, he gets so into the football game that midway through the first half, he kind of jumps out of the stands, runs down the stairs, and catapults over a fence onto the field and begins backslapping the Navy players and kind of getting the crowd into it. So Roosevelt's a tough guy to protect at this point, and he doesn't seem concerned at all, which I think the public loves.
He was rooting for the Navy. A president shouldn't root for one team over another, but he was rooting for the Navy because he had been the assistant secretary of the Navy?
Well, so actually he roots for the Navy with everything he's got in the first half, and then at halftime he gets up and crosses the field and sits on the Army side for the second half. You know, as a Rough Rider, he'd been in the Army, and as an assistant secretary of the Navy, he's got ties there. So he's very he tries to remain neutral. But Roosevelt, throughout his life, had been interested in the Navy. He writes a history of the Navy. So if I were betting, I'd say he's probably rooting for Navy, but he tries to keep it fair.
Now, the game was suspended for a time in the 1890s. Why did they stop playing that matchup, and what made them resume it? And how different was football that they played then?
Yeah, great questions. So the Army-Navy football game starts in the 1890s, and almost immediately the academies get really into it. The students and cadets get really into it. But the game is halted after one matchup when a couple of high-ranking officials from, one from Annapolis, one from West Point, almost get into a fight or a duel. There's even talk of a duel. And so at that point, they decide this is not serving the purpose that it's supposed to serve. So they do shut down the game for a couple of years. And Roosevelt, as Assistant Secretary of Navy, will write a letter to kind of restart the idea, to make an argument that the game needs to come back. But football in the 1890s is really different than what we think of today. You know, we're right here. Football season starts, I guess, this week, college football. We think of long passes and really intricate plays and, of course, violence as well. The game at Roosevelt's time is really just a barreling mass of humanity with a ball rattling around in there somewhere. People get hurt all the time. There's deaths on the field. So the game is really brutal at this time.
More like
rugby? Actually,
more
like rugby. It's a defensive battle. I mean, basically the sides will kind of dig in their territory. It's really hard to move the ball. And so it's just brute force that oftentimes is what moves a team down the field. This is right before, or pretty close before, the beginning of the allowance of the forward pass. And so, it's a rugby-esque kind of scrummage at this point.
The Ivy League was the apex of college athletics at the time, and he, of course, had gone to Harvard. Was it football the most prominent college sport at the time?
Yes, college football.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say college football almost immediately moves to the forefront. I mean, when the first game takes place in the 1860s, it just is wildly successful on college campuses. It appeals to, college men who compete, but it also really appeals to alumni, and it becomes this gathering point that it still is today. You go see a big game with everybody coming in and all the alums coming back and giving money. College football is always the biggest deal on campus.
And were the games suspended at on the Harvard and Yale level as well?
So Harvard really pushes to suspend football during the time. Actually, so if you fast forward from the time Roosevelt was there, during the time Roosevelt's in the White House, the president of Harvard, Charles Eliot, is a leading abolitionist of football. He wants football out of Harvard. He sees it as injuring people, taking away attention from the university mission. And so he does everything he can to get Harvard to eradicate or to outlaw the game. And he's pretty close. But Roosevelt intervenes a little bit. And the game survives with some modifications, but Harvard's pretty close to getting rid of the game.
Because they felt that Yale was unable to compete academically and enjoyed the opportunity, to embarrass them. His son, Roosevelt's oldest son, becomes a football player. Did he do it to please his father?
I think that's a fair guess. Ted Jr., it's tough to be Roosevelt's son, obviously. And so when he goes off to Harvard, the one thing that he can do really, one of the things he can do to separate himself from his father is take to the gridiron. That's something that Teddy never was able to do. So,
and how did he do?
He does okay. He, as a freshman, he makes the freshman team, which is a big deal at this time. You know, there's hundreds of guys trying out. He gets playing time. And actually, the press, of course, is highly attuned to what the president's son is doing. And they note over and over again that he's a really courageous little player. He's small. But he does well until the Harvard game, or excuse me, a game versus Yale, where he breaks his nose and gets a concussion and is kind of carried away from the field. But even that makes his father really proud, and I imagine gives Ted some pleasure as well.
Was it the controversy about football that gave rise to the NCAA?
Yes. Yes. So as football becomes increasingly violent and people like Charles Elliott, the president of Harvard, are arguing it has no place on university campuses, there's a series of reform movements and organizations which try to make the game safe enough to limit the deaths on the field, but keep its violent, you know, kind of popularity as well. So out of a series of meetings and a series of organizations, the NCAA forms at the beginning of 1906.
And what was the McCracken meeting?
That's one of these meetings along the way to think about how you can penalize players for excessively violent hits and how you can get the different schools to sign on to cooperate to enforce these rules. So that's one of these important steps along the way.
So the same thing was happening in less prestigious schools around the country at the time?
Yes, absolutely. There's deaths on the field and terrible injuries across the country, big, small schools, or big schools, small schools. It's happening everywhere.
What was the New York City Public Schools Athletic League? When was it announced?
Yeah, so I would argue perhaps that the biggest, most impactful thing that comes out of this era is the rise of interscholastic, you know, school-based sports. And in 1903, the Public Schools Athletic League is formed in New York City, and this is almost immediately becomes one of the most important athletic organizations in the country. You know, at the time, we're talking 600,000 students, a multi-million dollar budget, and they hire a guy named Luther Gulick to basically make these children who are part of the school system healthier. And the way that he sees to do that is both to do physical testing, kind of like the presidential fitness test that some of us remember, and then athletic competition. So he'll hold these big track meets and basketball tournaments. And from New York, you know how it is. New York impacts everything else. So what New York does, the rest of the nation quickly adopts, and school-based sports become really important.
Was there a belief that this kind of effort was necessary in cities because urban children got less exercise in their lives than children growing up in the country?
Absolutely. The people, you know, if you look through the minutes of the board meetings leading to the establishment of the Public Schools Athletic League, there's the belief that there's this crisis. You know, the country boys are out there lifting hay bales and putting fence posts in, and look what our city kids are doing. They're not doing anything. So athletics is a way to help them. And while boys are the focus, girls are part of this as well. The PSAL will include girls relatively quickly, which, you know, again, of course, is far from Title IX or equality, but we start to see the beginnings of that here as well.
And Luther Gulick is almost a revolutionary. His parents were missionaries, and how did that lead him to become interested in physical fitness?
He is absolutely a revolutionary. He's one of the favorite characters that I got to study in this book. He's kind of a wild man. He questions everything. He's an experimenter. He tries different things. But yes, he's absolutely a devout Christian. He's the son of missionaries. And so he sees his role as connecting the physical and the spiritual in a way that promotes, you know, positive development. And this certainly is part of the broader development that we know of as muscular Christianity. But he takes these ideas and kind of melds together science and Christianity and physical education and creates this sports program. And, you know, he helps create the game of basketball and establishes youth sports. And so I think, you know, in some ways, if we're looking for a revolutionary out of all this, Gulick is certainly one of the major ones.
And he is interested in what became known as muscular Christianity.
Yes.
What positions did he have in the New York City Board of Education? Was he ahead of his time?
Absolutely. I think you could argue that he's kind of dragging the school district forward at this point. They hire him in this, you know, directorship of physical education, but they give him almost no resources. There are no gymnasiums hardly at this point. There are very few PE teachers. And so he's always pushing. You know, he'll argue, I need more gymnasiums built. We should try this big tournament. He'll buy fields in different parts of the city for his contests. So he's always pushing the envelope, always introducing new sports. So he's, you know, he gets his foot in the door when he's hired, but he's always pushing the envelope from that point forward.
How and when did they decide to approach the president? When did Roosevelt become officially involved in the New York City PSAL?
Well, there's some crossover in terms of people who are either, you know, prominent in the Republican Party, and given that Roosevelt has New York City roots, there's always, so from the beginning of the time that the PSAL is put together, they always have important members of the Vanderbilts and other people like that who are on their board, and so they always see Roosevelt as the prize. If we can get Roosevelt to sign on as the honorary president, you know, that'll kind of really show people going forward. And it only takes a year or so before Roosevelt writes this strong letter of support and becomes the honorary president of the PSAL. And it's something he really believes in. It's basically what he had wanted for his own children. And so when one of the leagues within the PSAL decides to name itself the Roosevelt Athletic League, by all accounts, Roosevelt is really honored, and this is something he believes in. So he's really on their radar from the start.
Well, when Roosevelt was governor of New York State, he desegregated the schools. Did the PSAL promote racial equality? Because Roosevelt, to some degree, was what might be called a gradual integrationist. He didn't think that it should happen very quickly, and then, of course, it was stopped when Woodrow Wilson became president.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So right from the start, the first major athletic competition the PSAL has, you know, right around Christmas 1903, it is integrated. There are competitors of, you know, different races, black and white, competing there. So on that level, the PSAL from the beginning is rather progressive. But as you say, it's, you know, it's halting. There's, you know, very rarely do sports really leap, you know, bounds ahead of the rest of society. So, you know, competition among schoolboys of different races is generally accepted by the PSAL, but there's pushback, too.
Well, Roosevelt called white Americans the forward race and people of color the backward races. Mm-hmm. And then he said, and I'm quoting, "I don't go so far as to think that the only good Indians are the dead Indians, but I believe 9 out of 10 are, and I shouldn't like to inquire too closely into the case of the 10th. So he had his racist side as well.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, I think any whitewashing of Roosevelt's kind of imperialistic, racist mindset is, you know, it's not good history. He absolutely believes in a stronger race, the whites being a stronger race, superior race. I think he has moments during his life and his administration where he demonstrates that he is committed to kind of an individual equality. He wants people treated on a case-by-case basis, you know, with dignity and respect. You know, he famously has Booker T. Washington to the White House for dinner, which, you know, is a symbolic gesture of some sorts. But no, Roosevelt, as he thinks about athletics, he absolutely can get to a place in his mind where he connects it with racial survival. And so that's part of this story as well. And as we think about the way that sports operate today in terms of race, that's certainly part of the background in all these discussions.
He thought that in time we could teach the lesser races to catch up, but it would take a while.
Yeah. That's right.
Why wasn't he a baseball fan? After all, as I mentioned earlier, the first World Series was held during his presidency.
Yeah. So, you know, in writing this book, this was another part of the story I really enjoyed, because Roosevelt can hardly get enough of sports, right? He's competing, you know, daily. He's highly in tune with sports scores. He wants to know which college team has won. But the one exception is the nation's most popular sport, baseball. So during Roosevelt's time as president, he has what I call a cold war with baseball. He ignores the game, and then when leaders of baseball reach out to him and ask him, they give him a golden ticket, you know, invite him to come see the Senators in Washington, D.C., he'll accept the ticket, but he refuses to go to any baseball games as president, which really stands out given his kind of strenuous life reputation. And then, you know, baseball, during his time as president, the number of people attending baseball games in the United States more than doubles. So the game is growing, but Roosevelt is not one of those people. And I think it's a good reminder that presidential persuasion, you know, as we look back, we think, oh, this president is connected to this movement. But no, it's not that simple. And so I speculate in the book as to why Roosevelt shuns baseball. And his daughter will say it's because the game is not violent enough or it's not physically taxing enough, which perhaps is part of it. He certainly likes baseball and football and kind of these exhausting endurance sports. But I think part of it perhaps as well is just the fact that Roosevelt struggled so mightily with his eyesight for his whole lifetime. And if you think about the need to see in playing sports or watching sports even for that matter, you know, visual acuity is big in baseball. And so I think that's part of it too. But it's a funny push back and forth between baseball and Roosevelt during this time.
Did he play a role in bringing the Olympics to the United States?
He does, kind of a minor role, but you know, the modern Olympic Games start back up in 1896. They're in Greece, and then in 1900 they're in Paris, and in part because of the athletic culture that's really fostered by Roosevelt, the United States is seen as really the only place for 1904. That's where the games have to be, and so in that way, Roosevelt, the strenuous president, kind of makes that decision for the IOC, the International Olympic Committee. The games are originally awarded to Chicago, but then St. Louis actually is able to kind of wrest them away. And in the end, the 1904 Olympic Games become part of a year delayed celebration of the Louisiana Purchase, which is kind of odd if you think about it. So the United States kind of takes hosting this first Olympic Games and makes it part of the celebration of its imperialism to a certain extent. So Roosevelt, you know, he becomes an honorary president of the Olympic Games. He will greet the Olympic athletes after the games are over. He attends the World Fair that's connected with it. So I think Roosevelt helps create the culture that makes the first games possible in the United States.
But it's interesting that the Roosevelt, who is somewhat a symbol of American imperialism, won the Nobel Peace Prize in 1906.
Yeah, it is interesting. And I think there's been many scholars who have speculated on you know, how this award was granted to him. And I think given his background and his imperialistic mindset, there's good reason to question it. But I will say also Roosevelt is a connector of people, to put it simply. He is very interested in what's going on in the world. He's not an isolationist. And so in that case, his, you know, his role with Russia and Japan makes sense. And so as we, you know, if you think about, you know, Obama receiving the award here not too long ago, there's often questions about who gets what, but I think it speaks to Roosevelt's interest in the world, perhaps as much as anything.
He was also a prolific writer. Did he write much about sports?
He does. Yeah, Roosevelt, I mean, you know, if you want to feel badly about yourself, you study Roosevelt, because, you know, here I am, I do a little writing and a little teaching, but Roosevelt publishes, depending on who, you know, the count, about 38 books, 150,000 letters.
And 38 books?
38 books,
oh,
yeah.
My.
So very prolific. And in doing so, yes, he writes pages and pages about sports. And in doing so, it's usually connected to this idea that we can use sports to make ourselves better. Better people, better Americans, stronger. And so that's, you know, he writes his book. He writes a book in 1902 called The Strenuous Life, which takes the speech that he gives and then augments it with other things. And so he very much connects sports with parenting, for example, and he will talk about his own children in that way. So of the, you know, hundreds of thousands of pages he writes, many are dealing with sports in some way, although certainly not most.
Did he also connect the sports to the way he governed?
Yes, he does. Roosevelt sees the pursuit of athletics as a way of living fearlessly and daring greatly. His famous speech, Man in the Arena, I think has athletic undertones to it because Roosevelt sees the way that we live physically in the world as connected to our character. And, you know, therefore he will connect it broadly to the United States as well. So if the American people are successful athletically, they are robust, they are strenuous, he sees that as connected to the way that they will act in the world. So he's very interested in connecting his ideas about the spiritual side, physical side, intellectual side. He always wants to bring them together.
I remember studying him in my high school history class, and he came across as a rather positive figure. The warts side didn't come up very much. Do you think that that continues, that his image remains as one of the our favorite presidents in history?
I think it does, to a certain extent. I mean, if you think of the, not very scholarly at all, but entertaining movies, you know, Night at the Museum, where Roosevelt comes back to life and plays this enthusiastic guy romping around in a museum at night. Of course, that's Ben Stiller. It's a movie that's there's still an element of Americans like to think of Roosevelt that way, as just this energy, enthusiastic, going after it kind of guy. But with that said, I think over the past 10 years, 20 years or so, we've become really much more knowledgeable about the fact that Roosevelt did have racist undertones to his paradigm. He was an imperialist who thought America should conquer and fight. So I think there's a pretty good understanding of both sides of Roosevelt. But I will say, you know, studying him, his energy and his curiosity and his willingness to kind of fight against his own weaknesses, they are seducing. I mean, you like him and you feel inspired by him the more you read about him. But again, it doesn't take away the warts that he has.
I remember something that my high school history teacher told us, a story about when he was police commissioner and a terrible pre-Nazi anti-Semite came to America, and there was a lot of concern about whether somebody would try to kill him, and he assigned Jewish policemen to protect the man as a way of humiliating him and making a point as well.
Mm-hmm.
So he could be quite clever. He also was played a role in the creation of New York museums, the Metropolitan Museum, mm-hmm. the Museum of Natural History. And, as you point out, he played a major role in the making of the American athlete. I thank you so much for being on our show. Ryan Swanson's book is The Strenuous Life, Theodore Roosevelt and the Making of the American Athlete. It is published by Diversion Books. It's been a great pleasure.
Thanks so much. It was great to chat with you.
And that brings us to the end of today's show. Our special thanks to Fran Higgins, who produced today's segment. If you're new to this program and you like what you've been hearing, you can access past shows streaming on demand at WBAI.org. We're also available as an iTunes podcast. And don't forget to check out Leonard Lopate at Large on Facebook and Twitter. Also, our website, leonardlopateatlarge.com, where you can find links to all of our past shows. The Tom Hartman Program is coming up next, and we hope you'll join us again tomorrow when my guest will be Sue Rome. We'll talk about the emergence of Dada and Surrealism in Paris in the early 20th century. We'll see you then.
On Tuesday, August 20th at 10 p.m., Sugar in My Bowl asks communities to stay, fight, and build as we talk to Vivian Vasquez Irizarry, director and producer of Decades of Fire, which looks at the policies of racism and neglect that still shape our communities while offering hope for today. We'll also talk to Moikansi Gama of Image Nation, who will screen the film on August 23rd. That's Tuesday, August 20th at 10 p.m., right here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, and WBAI.org on the web.
You are tuned to listener-sponsored community radio, WBAI New York, and WBAI.org online. The previous program was Leonard Lopate at Large, heard Monday through Friday at 1 p.m. Stay tuned for the Tom Hartman program, but first, news headlines from Democracy Now!
The New York City police officer who killed Eric Garner in 2014 by using an illegal chokehold has been fired. New York Police Department Commissioner James O'Neill announced his decision Monday, just over 5 years after the killing, which sparked nationwide outrage. Daniel Pantaleo used the banned chokehold on unarmed African-American Eric Garner until he dropped to the ground, Garner gasping, "I can't breathe," 11 times. Pantaleo had remained on the police force on desk duty. A New York grand jury decided in 2014 not to charge him, and last month the Justice Department said he would also not face federal charges. Earlier this month, a police administrative judge found the officer guilty of violating the New York Police Department ban on chokeholds and recommended he be fired. This is Garner's mother, Gwen Carr, speaking Monday at a rally outside police headquarters.
I'm still out here. I'm out here for the long run. You come out here against me, I'm out here.
That's right.
And you cannot scare me away. Yeah, Pantaleo, you may have lost your job, but I lost a son. July 17, 2014. I lost my son. You cannot replace that. You can get another job.
Planned Parenthood has withdrawn from Title 10, the federal program that funds family planning services for millions of low-income people as they refuse to comply with the